Did the White House deliberately seek to blow Valerie Plame's covert status to punish her husband, Joe Wilson, for his accusations about the administration's misuse of intelligence? I don't believe it was to punish him. Rather, I believe she simply became a talking point for some in a larger campaign led by the vice president to discredit Wilson publicly and thereby diminish the effectiveness of his criticisms. The president was only generally aware of this larger campaign and authorized Cheney to use parts of the NIE to support it. When the vice president sought to find out how Wilson was selected by the CIA to go on the trip to Niger, his wife's identity and role at the agency became known. As documents disclosed by Fitzgerald with the vice president's handwriting on them show, Cheney wondered whether the trip was a junket based on nepotism that his wife helped arrange. As Cheney and Scooter Libby, his chief of staff and national security advisor, began to dig into the story, Plame's identity started to circulate among administration officials at the CIA, State Department, and vice president's office. Some have defended Libby and Rove, saying they weren't the ones who leaked Plame's identity to Novak. In fact, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage was the first to do so. But before Novak publicly disclosed Plame's identity, Libby and Rove did tell other reporters about her, and Rove became Novak's second confirming source for his article. Libby became a key player in the effort to discredit Wilson, while as Fitzgerald stated in his closing arguments, Plame's identity became just another weapon for him in the Washington political wars. As far as Libby was concerned, Fitzgerald said, "She wasn't Valerie Wilson. She wasn't a person. She was an argument, a fact to use against Joe Wilson." I think Fitzgerald was right. Did the vice president specifically direct Libby to disclose Plame's identity? I don't know. Libby's lawyers claim that Fitzgerald was seeking to suggest a cloud over the vice presidency at the trial without any evidence. But the special counsel strongly disagreed. "We didn't put that cloud there. That cloud remains because the defendant obstructed justice and lied about what happened," Fitzgerald stated. Was Bush aware of the disclosure of Plame's identity? I know of nothing to suggest he was, nor do I believe he was, based on my conversations with him at the time. In fact, his words to me indicate that he was misled by Rove, too. Fitzgerald also stated in court filings that the president was unaware of the role that Libby had in fact played in disclosing Ms. Wilson's CIA employment. Did his secret authorization for Cheney to get out parts of the NIE set in motion the disclosure of Plame's identity? Possibly. It certainly encouraged the anonymous efforts to counter Wilson's accusations. Sadly, that's the way the game in Washington gets played. Was an underlying crime committed by anyone in the administration by disclosing Plame's identity? I don't know. Armitage was Robert Novak's initial source concerning Plame's identity, and prosecutors seem to believe that it was unintentional on Armitage's part. But it's false to assert that he was the only one who disclosed Plame's identity. We now know that Libby, Rove, and Ari Fleischer also disclosed their identity to reporters before Novak reported it. Fleischer apparently did so unaware of her classified status. Rove continues to maintain that he did not leak her name and that he disclosed her identity to Cooper only to prevent him from reporting something inaccurate. Whether they committed a crime by revealing Plame's identity is something I don't know. It is in part a technical legal issue that I'm not qualified to judge. None of these men were charged with a crime for revealing her identity. But I do know that what they did was wrong and harmful to national security, regardless of whether her disclosure was detrimental to any sources or methods. Plame was a covert CIA officer at the time, and they shouldn't have been discussing this with reporters, whether it was an indictable offense or not. The vice president's office sought to find out why Wilson was sent to Niger. When his wife's name was mentioned, it started to circulate within the State Department and White House, creating a permissive environment for her identity to be disclosed. As revealed in court filings, Libby sought to enlist Ari Fleischer's help in making it known to reporters. After Novak contacted Rove, Rove went to Libby and let him know that Novak was writing about her role. Rove also disclosed her identity to Matt Cooper of Time magazine. As for what Rove and Libby told me when I was asked to publicly exonerate them, I can only conclude that they knowingly misled me. The facts have been recounted in this book, but set aside what I've written and consider another important fact. All objective observers, based on the facts that have become public, agree that what I said on their behalf was false. They were, in fact, involved in anonymously disclosing her identity, or leaking it, to some reporters. And I stated publicly at the time that my comments were based on personal assurances given to me by Carl and Scooter. I said they had assured me they were not involved in the leaking of classified information. I would never have made that statement had I known the facts. Neither man ever sought to correct the record when he could have. Instead, he let my word stand for 2 years. Rove was being too cute by half when he told CNN and later ABC News back in 2004, I did not know her name, I did not leak her name. He did not have to know Plame's name to leak her identity, as he did to Time Magazine White House correspondent Matt Cooper, and as he confirmed for Bob Novak. So both Rove and Libby deliberately allowed me to tell the public falsehoods on their behalf, a clear abuse of the White House press secretary's role. But I hold myself responsible for allowing that to happen. I should not have put myself in such a position, period. It's also clear to me that Scooter Libby was guilty of the perjury and obstruction crimes for which he was convicted. When the president commuted Libby's prison sentence and thereby protected him from serving even one day behind bars, I was disappointed. This kind of special treatment undermines our system of justice. It's not that I wanted to see someone I once worked alongside serve time. Prison is no joke, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody I knew or cared about. And it certainly has nothing to do with personal resentment on my part. Life is too short to waste time or energy on grudges. But I believe in the rule of law, and I think a president and those who serve a president have a special obligation to live up to both the letter and the spirit of the law. President Bush certainly has the right and the power to commute Libby's sentence. But in choosing to do so, he sent an unfortunate message to America and the world that in the United States, criminal behavior on behalf of a political cause may go unpunished if those who support that cause have the power to make it happen. Those in power have access to a different system of justice. As I've explained in this book, I think it's unfortunate that the partisan, winner-take-all mentality of the permanent campaign has come to exert so much influence over the way our nation is governed. Intervening to circumvent a legally sound and morally just verdict because the defendant happens to be politically connected may be a symptom of just such a deplorable trend. And what about the 16 words controversy behind it all? Was the Bush administration guilty of a deliberate attempt to mislead the American people with the 16 words? I don't think so. I think that the researchers at the Annenberg Political Fact Check, which describes itself as a nonpartisan advocate for voters that aims to reduce the level of deception and confusion in U.S. politics, gets it about right on its acclaimed website, factcheck.org. Quote, none of the new information suggests Iraq ever nailed down a deal to buy uranium, and the Senate report makes clear that U.S. intelligence analysts have come to doubt whether Iraq was ever trying to buy the stuff. In fact, both the White House and the CIA long ago conceded that the 16 words shouldn't have been part of Bush's speech. But what he said, that Iraq sought uranium, is just what both British and U.S. intelligence were telling him at the time. So Bush may indeed have been misinformed, but that's not the same as lying. The 16 words in Bush's State of the Union address on January 28, 2003, have been offered as evidence that the president led the U.S. into war using false information intentionally. The new reports show Bush accurately stated what British intelligence was saying and that CIA analysts believed the same thing. Unquote. This doesn't mean the Bush administration was blameless in the way it handled intelligence during the run-up to war. As I've detailed in this book, the campaign mentality at times led the president and his chief advisors to spin, hide, shade, and exaggerate the truth, obscuring nuances and ignoring the caveats that should have accompanied their arguments. Rather than choosing to be forthright and candid, they chose to sell the war, and in so doing, they did a disservice to the American people and to our democracy. However, this is not the same as saying they deliberately misled and lied. Words that are emotionally charged and tend to obscure important truths and lessons in the fog of political sniping over difficult-to-prove accusations. As far as I can see, The evidence clearly supports one charge, but not the other. However, embracing the permanent campaign tactics that increasingly fuel a culture of deception in Washington is just as problematic in its own way. I don't believe the path to better democracy is served by exaggerated claims, distorted partisan attacks, or unsupported accusations of bad faith. Neither of our leading political parties is a repository of evil, and the vast majority of leaders on both sides of the aisle and at all levels of government are decent, well-meaning, and hardworking citizens who love our country and want to do the right thing. In diagnosing the problems we suffer from and the kinds of changes we need to make, I think it's crucial to cling to the truth, even when it is more nuanced, complex, and ambiguous than extreme partisans on either side may choose to believe.